Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Once a month, Mayor Vi Lyles joins us to talk about all things Charlotte. This is that day, and among other things we'll talk about are transportation, crime, and the 9 affordable housing projects the council will vote on at Monday night's meeting. I believe that's correct. Welcome back. Good to see you again.
It's good to see you. Thanks for having me. Good morning, Charlotte.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can watch us on Facebook Live. Actually, the camera's pointed more at the mayor. Let's start with one of the things that you're pretty enthusiastic about, and that is affordable housing. It was one of your campaign goals when you ran last time. And on Monday, City Council, as I said, will vote on 8 different projects, I believe, that have the potential of providing 950 affordable housing units across the city. Some are new, some are rehabs. How many of each? Do you know?
There are 2 rehab projects out of the group, and those are in existing apartment complexes that we're going to renovate and have a rent requirement that lasts a certain term of years. Usually we try for anywhere between 10 to 30 years of affordability for those types of projects. And we've been very successful. I have to thank the community for the work that they've done. We have a partnership with LIS, which is a neighborhood foundation group that tries to make sure our neighborhoods are strong, national group that came in here and helped us with the underwriting from the $50 million that the private sector provided, as well as the bond money that the voters chose to approve.
The bond money is $50 million, which we approved last November. There's also money, about $50 million or more, from private companies that have also kicked in. These funds are what's being used to fund the purchase and the help to rehab some of these projects, correct?
Exactly.
If council votes, yes, what's the likelihood of that?
Oh, I'm hoping for a unanimous vote. I think that we've talked about this for so long that finally getting projects that are going to come out of the ground in 2020 is an important thing that we build trust with the community. I still have people that walk up every day and say, you said that you were going to do something about housing, and where do I apply and how do I get into it? So these units will be under construction or renovation beginning in January when the financing is finally all documented, and they're probably not going to come out of the ground until 18 to 24 months. So people are hurting now, and I understand that, but we had to start somewhere, and I think this 950 units, our lowest rent will be $377 a month in one of these apartments that we're talking about.
And what do you get for $377?
You get just what you would get if you were paying $1,000. There's no differentiation between the a quality of the unit or the size of the unit. Is by being using your income to make sure that you qualify for the rent. And we require that 20% of the units qualify for people that make less than 30% of our average income for a family of 4. And I've gotten this question, well, how can a family of 4 live in a 1-bedroom or a 2-bedroom? That is additionally adjusted for the size of your family.
So are they all apartments, or are some of them townhomes?
Are primarily apartments.
Okay.
In this case, usually when we see townhomes, and what we're working for in townhome environments is the sale of a unit. And we're continuing to work on our ability to produce single-family homes for sale, working with 2 of the large industries, NAPCA and Neighborhood Lift at Wells Fargo. One's funded by Wells Fargo and one is funded by Bank of America. And that's where we get our 80% people that are making 80% of our average minimum income, where they can get loans to purchase, and we help with down payment assistance as well as our 2 major financial institutions.
We'll talk more about this AMI number, this average median income, in a moment or two. Where are the new developments? Where are the ones that you're refurbishing? Are they all over town, or are they in one particular area of town? Where are they?
You know, they're going to be all over town. One I'm thinking of, we will have on 7th Street in the center city, proximity to center. Center City, and it includes a developer working with Little Rock AME Zion Church. And so when you think about where Trinity Episcopal School is, mm-hmm. we're talking about two blocks over. We're also talking about Westerly Hills. We're talking about Tivola Road. We have a good mix spread around the community.
So the ones that are being built, will all of the, in these particular developments that are being built from scratch, coming out of the ground, will they all be affordable housing units, or will they be a mixture of affordable housing?
Most of these will be all of what I would call a mixed-use environment, but there will be a cap at 80%. So making 80% of AMI down to below 30.
Right.
Those are the folks, if anyone below 80%. So when we talked about who are those folks, that's where our police officers, our firefighters, the people that are, you know, the
teachers,
administrative assistants at law firms, people that are entering the bank and providing you the services that mm-hmm. you walk into the door. So those are the incomes that we're going to target. But we also will be targeting our people that could not get into what I would call the housing authority units. And they will have the opportunity to apply. In fact, we have designated a certain number of units for the choice voucher that you get from the housing authority, and those folks will come off of the waiting list at the at housing authority.
When you say the lower AMI units will be going to people who could not get into the housing authority units, is that because they're all full or because they didn't qualify for one reason or another?
Oh, it's absolutely a question of capacity. There's no availability for people,
okay.
and even our vouchers waiting list is very long.
And how do these new units and the ones you're refurbishing differ from the housing authority units that you talked about?
Well, you know, I think that most people understand that they're not different. I always say the most successful affordable housing project in our city is in First Ward. Mm-hmm. That's where you have all of those beautiful apartments that used to be Piedmont Courts.
Right.
That is one-third subsidized, one-third under 30%, and one-third market. And that's the kind of proximity that we want for our units, except we're going to cap it at 80% of our AMI, which I know you're going to ask me exactly what that amount is, and I'm going to have to make sure that I get that from Pam Whiteman, who does this all the time in our city. But we are going to be looking at that kind of mixed-use, mixed-income development.
Let me ask you, how much is that 80%? I'm just kidding.
I know you would do that, Mike. You know, some days my head doesn't keep a lot of numbers in it.
So talk to me about the ones you're refurbishing. These are units that are currently being rented or have been lived in, and they are owned, I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, by private owners. So how were they chosen? Why are private owners benefiting from the largesse of the city in refurbishing these units?
Well, the simple answer is that you have a choice of helping owners maintain affordable properties, or they're going to build something differently, and that will be a higher
income. In other words, these owners would, in lieu of your help, would just raise these buildings and make money by building something else.
That's exactly right. And a lot of this has to do with federal tax codes, mm-hmm. when your depreciation has ended, when you get the you've reached the term that the you get the opportunity to apply for a tax credit. So what we're doing is taking this and putting them back into circulation, preventing them from evicting the number of people that they have. In one of our units, in Wendover Walk Apartments, there are over 90 units that are currently affordable. If we lost those and we start thinking about that kind of loss, we would not be able to ever keep up. The deficit is so great right now that renovation and helping people keep that affordability unit is just as important as building the new.
So let's talk about one of these. I'm just going to pick one out of the air here.
Okay.
I'm not picking on anybody, but Heritage Park Apartments, they're owned by private concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And just to use them as an example, they requested $600,000 to upgrade 151 units, of which 50 will be priced for those at 30% of mm-hmm. the average median income levels. And the main remaining units will be those between 51 to 60% of the AMI
level. It's a great mix.
So that puts rent for those units between, I understand, $826 and $1,230 a month. The owner of another project requested slightly more money, but also intends to offer more units aimed at those at the 30% level mm-hmm. of AMI. So explain how this works for private owners who get this money, are they locked into doing this for a long period of time? Are they locked into keeping these units up in terms of maintenance and things like that? Or once they get the money, are they on their own?
No, they're locked into a requirement by accepting this opportunity to participate in this funding. They're locked into affordability under our existing 4%. Now, we've been doing these deals forever. It's just the number of deals that we get to do through the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency. And so what we're doing is we are locking in that rent for the time frame that that's required for the eligibility of funding, and that's usually 2 to 3 generations. I'd like to say more on the 3, but often it's at least, you know, when I think about it, it's 15 years or 20 years.
Okay. So how do people who need these units, how do they get into them?
Well, actually, these folks, because they're in an existing unit now, they will stay. And that's why I said it's just as important to get people to stay where they are than as well as building. So they will stay.
So what kind of repairs or refurbishments are being done?
Well, you know, the units were built, for example, you talk about Heritage Park. They were constructed in 1981, and they actually have some of the amenities. They have a clubhouse, and they have laundry facilities. But 1981 and the standards that we'd like to see for affordable housing today in a community, there'll be more amenities. So they're going to do preservation, and what they've done over this company has been working on this kind of effort in cooperation with other communities. I think that what you'll see is the upgrade in appliances for energy efficiency. These are things, small things that we don't think about, but if you've got an old refrigerator that's kind of just knocking out mm-hmm. the electricity, your bill becomes very high, and we want people to have energy efficiency units, the apartment as well as the appliances. Some of the upgrades, instead of the towel worn out, I mean, even those 9 by 9 squares, they wear out, and we'll be doing those kinds of replacements, plus the grounds. We want every community, when you drive by it, to look like it integrates with the entire city.
Okay. So the council votes on this Monday night.
Yes.
Do they vote on this as a block, or do they vote up and vote down individual projects?
Well, you know, that's a council decision. I'd love to see a motion that talks about we approve all of these at one time and that we have unanimous support. But that's a decision the council can decide, that which whether or not they want to pull out a unit. We've had some sessions trying to make sure that everybody understands what's going on. So we've had Liz come in, our city team to come in to talk about the financing, the rehab, how it all works. I'm hoping for a unanimous vote.
Okay. Am I correct in saying that last month council approved a group of projects not unlike these, or am I?
No, I think that we had these in early spring. They come based on the federal schedule for eligibility.
So there's $100 million, $50 million in bonds, $50 million that has been kicked in by private concerns for this. If you do all these projects, when does the $100 million run out?
I think we've got at least 3 to 4 more cycles that we can go through. When we put all of this together, the Housing Trust Fund commitment was cut in half. And so we can do more of these because we have the extra funding and a better lending environment. They can come in and get loans at 1%, the developers can. So I think we're going to be good for another year or two.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And these two actions taken together, well, the stuff that was approved in the spring, the stuff that is likely to be approved on Monday, mm-hmm. how will that impact and how quickly will that impact our deficit of housing?
Our deficit of housing is continuing to grow, and we're not going to be able to keep up this way. So I start thinking about these things in a way that is not just the new construction, which will be up in 2 years, but we now need to talk about how do we get more preservation, and I want to work with the Apartment Association and the Realtors Association to do that.
Charlotte Mayor Vial-Lyles is with us. We come back in a moment. We'll talk about immigration. We'll talk about the rising homicide count in the city, the environment, and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Mayor Vi Lyle. She joined us just about every month to talk about things that are going on in the city. Last weekend, ICE, under orders from the Trump administration, was to have begun raids on immigrants. Let's just put it that way. That didn't seem to happen to the degree that it was promised to happen, many were predicting, but the prospect did send shivers to a lot of immigrant communities here and around the country. Charlotte wasn't announced as a target. If you looked at the national news, they pinpointed cities, including Atlanta, I think Philadelphia, and up places in California and Texas, as places they were definitely going to go in and remove people. Did it surprise you? I mean, we're not participating in the 287G program. ICE had already said, because we're not participating, Charlotte was going to become a target of increased scrutiny. Did it surprise you we weren't on that list?
I was grateful that we were not on the list, and I was a bit surprised because I think that we have had a number of conversations at the state level and here in Charlotte about that program, and it surprised me. But I also thought about this, that the state has legislation that is currently underway to actually take a requirement to make the sheriff support the programs across the state. And I thought, well, maybe that was what stopped that, but who knows what goes on in the mind of people that are doing this work that prevents people from coming to this country for opportunity. I'm not quite sure.
So last month, Charlotte City Council voted unanimously to pass what is called an immigration compact. It made Charlotte the first city government in the country to adopt a statement of support for immigrants. What does that statement say?
Now, I think the statement, more than anything, expresses our values for an inclusive and diverse city. What it really does is that we are really going to work in a way that when we have an immigrant community, that we are sustaining their ability to become a part of our city and a part of what I think is a great democracy.
You're a Democrat. President Trump and others in the Republican Party portray Democrats as wanting open borders and wanting the vast hordes to come in droves over our borders. You don't want borders.
The hyperbole is
well. You're
is
not.
There,
you're right. A Democrat, therefore you don't believe in borders. So that's how you're being portrayed. So let me just ask: the problem with immigration is a federal problem.
Yes.
That nobody in the federal government seems to be willing or able to address. And we've been talking about this on this program for 20 years, and it's much older program than that, a much older problem than that. What do you say to people who say, if you come here without going through channels, you shouldn't be here?
I don't think about it in those terms of a binary system. You're either absolutely, you know, shouldn't be here, or you absolutely should be here.
I mean, on the one hand, you have Democrats complaining that the President Trump does not believe in the rule of law and that the federal government is breaking down because of his administration ignoring the rule of law. On the other hand, they point to Democrats saying, you want people to come here lawlessly, breaking down the rule of law. Do we have a rule of law country anymore?
Okay, Mike, you're asking me a question that's probably being debated nationally. Today I watched the news, and it was just amazing how immigration has been taking over this country's conversation. Instead of it being about how do we get the best workforce and the good people in this community to be a part of it. So I can't even imagine. I want Charlotte to be the city that talks about including people, that talks about the opportunity to get jobs here. I serve on that task force from the president, and the Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, has said we need to fix immigration laws.
We need
the
those
jobs
workers.
Of the future right. are going to require more population than we have here. Everybody talks about boomers and millennials. Well, they're equal in population, but the growth and change required for us to have pathways for jobs of the future requires us to ask everyone. We need to actually increase the opportunity for people to work.
When you say jobs of the future, what kind of jobs are you talking about? Because there was a story on 60 Minutes on Sunday night that said within 5 or 6 years, 40% of the jobs in America will vanish, period, gone.
I understand that 40% might vanish, period, gone, but they didn't talk about what's going to substitute for those.
Right.
Central Piedmont has a program where they are working with young people to learn how to maintain a Tesla car. Now, you would think a Tesla doesn't have, you know, pistons and all of that, but it does have a computer that has to be updated, restored, and has to be monitored. So that job of, you know, I don't think it's going to be in cars, but advanced manufacturing requires an entirely different set of skills than the manufacturing that we had where you actually have the assembly line.
And we don't have enough people in this country to fill those jobs?
We do not, and we can see that with the HB2 visa system where people come here, they wait years and years to be qualified to get a position here in this country, and they're working here, and they have families that come, their kids are educated here, and we are not processing those visas in a timely way.
You just mentioned you were on the president's task force. Which task force does that remind me of?
This is the Workforce Development Task Force between the Commerce Secretary and Ivanka Trump to talk about what are the jobs of the future and how do we prepare people for them.
Is there a dichotomy within the administration? I mean, we have you on that task force, and then we have the president saying these people here are coming here and they're committing crimes and they're rapists and they're this and they're that. What are they? Are we in more danger? The Republicans say we're in more danger. Republicans in our own legislature say that we are in more danger because of what's going on with immigration, and Democrats don't seem to see that. So which is the truth?
You know, as a Democratic mayor who's running for re-election, I can see the politics of these situations. But underlying all of that, you know, rhetoric around this, we have to still do the work. We still have to do the work. And that's why in our community, we've outlined these principles that we're going to really advocate for federal immigration reform that works for our city. We're going to support the role that we have with existing immigrants in our local economy. And believe me, we've got to support all children. Every child deserves a chance to live. And I just think that what we have to do, it might be talked about in these headlines, but the work that has to go on to make a difference is going to take place at the local level. Mm. That's why Charlotte and many other urban centers are so important to cooperate where we can, but to also know we need to stand on our own when we have to.
So Charlotte City Council unanimously passed this immigration compact, which has been described as a values statement. It lacks concrete policy changes, but it is, I understand, the council's hope that this will lessen the fear of government among the immigrant community because of what's going on with the federal government, and in some cases local sheriff's departments, not here, there is a fear of going to the government for anything. And so that the hope is that this will be a friendly local government stance. How will that help?
So what that does is it allows for leaders in the immigrant community and across our entire city to be able to say, we're going to do things by the right way, the Charlotte way of including people. It allows us to actually look at some things. And this is an interesting little small thing. We do these tests on our water systems, and we leave the instructions in English. We have got to make those instructions in a different language, many different languages actually, because if we're going to do a testing of the water system and we're going to turn off your water and we only tell you in English and it's a community that's Latino or a community that's from Germany or India, well, how would you know what happens? These are just simple things that we all take for granted because we've had the privilege of knowing how to speak the tongue, the English, and others don't. So it allows for us to communicate better with every resident of the city in a language that they can understand that may actually impact their living here in a safe and healthy way.
So this first in the country statement, immigration compact that the council passed, does not make us a sanctuary city. We are not a sanctuary city. Is that correct?
We are not a sanctuary city. Sanctuary city has become a political word,
yes.
And that's not anything that I could describe or define.
Because North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis is taking aim at sanctuary cities with new legislation that could leave local communities facing a financial hit if they don't cooperate with ICE. If local jurisdictions don't waive immunity from these sorts of civil cases, I'm not sure what he's talking about here, they could miss out on federal grants. And this bill's in the early stages on Capitol
Hill. Very early stages.
Have you talked to his office about this at all?
I have not talked to his office because there is enough conversation going on about these ideas. And it was just introduced. I heard it, I think, on WFAE about it. So,
as one would.
That is as one would. And at some point, the senator and I will have a conversation about it. But, you know, we have to remind ourselves that some of these are reactions to another action, and it's just heightened and continue to grow.
Well, actions and reactions are happen all the time in politics, and I'm wondering if you think that by passing this value statement, we are poking the bear being the legislature. The last time Charlotte poked the bear, we're still feeling the impact of HB2, even though it's gone, but that was a response to our poking the bear. Do you worry we've done it again?
You know,
because they're working in Raleigh right now on legislation that would make us cooperate with ICE.
I work really hard to work in collaboration with our legislature and our governor. And I believe that when we do something like sign a document like this, mm-hmm. it's expressing our values and our beliefs, and it impacts our safety and the health of our community. I don't consider that poking a bear. I consider poking the bear when you're out, you know, denigrating the people or the institutions. That's not what we're doing. We're building an institution in this city that's strong and inclusive.
Speaking of statements, yesterday the U.S. House voted on a resolution condemning President Donald Trump's recent tweets, his what they called racist comments in his tweets, but they fell short of calling him a racist. If you make racist comments, aren't you by definition a racist?
Is that a question? I think if you're making racist comments, if you're actually in government and you're doing that, it is not a good position to take. I just don't understand this. We all know, I'm a black woman that grew up in the segregated South. We are dealing with these policies that were passed in the 40s and the 50s and all the way up until like the 70s. And so when you're making these kinds of statements around race and racism, I just don't understand why we're doing this. It is so hard to dismantle. I'm sorry. I don't know why this conversation is taking place, especially around four elected young women that are just trying to represent the people that elected them to office. I think this country's big enough and strong enough to accept the diversity of opinions, but not necessarily to characterize that diversity as being something that's negative for our country.
In response to what the president said in those tweets, one of those women that he targeted said that he's a white nationalist, and those are white nationalist words. We know that the trouble in Charlottesville a couple of years ago. We know that there has been an increase in hate crimes committed by people who profess to be white nationalists. You're one of the proponents of bringing the Republican National Convention to town. You've got these tweets a year out from that convention, and some people say he's just stirring the pot right now, and it'll get worse as we go through the election. Do you worry that bringing the Republican National Convention to town is going to bring all kinds of trouble?
I think that we look at every convention and we work really hard to make sure
this is not the Shriners.
This is not the Shriners, but we have hosted the National Rifle Association in Charlotte as well. That's just one of those groups that's a part of that whole discussion around what this country is going to be. I think that the way I look at the Republican convention is, yes, we need to make sure people have the ability to protest, and we need to make sure that we have a safe convention. But at the same time, I believe the Republican convention represents a time for this city to show its democratic values and strengths. When we talk about the immigration compact, there's going to be no apology that, you know, because you disagree with the premises of immigration, that we wouldn't have the ability to do this job because it's what's right for Charlotte.
But you are bringing a convention of people. I'm going to put it out there. You're bringing a convention of people who are in lockstep with the president who is tweeting out racist comments and who has inflamed fires in other directions that he doesn't have to do. But he's chosen to do it, for political purposes. He may not be a racist. I don't know. I don't know what's in his heart. But you're a woman of color, and you're the mayor of the city, and no other city in the country wanted this convention.
Well, I can't say that that's a fact. I've heard people say that, but I can't say that as a fact. I don't know that.
How does it make you feel that we're bringing this convention here of people who are not standing in opposition to very basic premises about America and American values?
I think that when we host this convention, we hosted the last one, or in 2012 for the Democrats.
Big difference.
I think there is a big difference, yes. But I also think that there was a time that we saw protests then. I expect that those protests are going to be much stronger, and they're going to be...
But do you worry that Charlotte will be painted with a brush that Charlotte puts their seal of approval on this kind of behavior, this kind of conduct, this kind of conversation?
I don't think that that's something that people will see in the way that we will manage this convention, as well as the way we will manage what's going on around it. We already have community groups talking about how do we have a real valid discussion. I think we're going to handle it in the true tradition of Charlotte, which is to say, let's sit down and talk about it. Let's figure out what we want to say, and there's going to be lots of opportunities to express where you feel and how you feel about this convention. And I know that there are a number of people that are in great pain because of this administration. I know that. I see it all the time. But at the same time, we've committed to do this, and so we're going to do it in the best way possible. But I am not going to ignore the fact that the administration often creates what I call crises of confidence in our government by choosing to divide us instead of bringing us together.
Let's move on to another topic, because there's nothing we can do about what happens in Washington.
We had
CMPD Chief Kirk Putney and Mecklenburg County District Attorney Spencer Merriweather on the program yesterday to talk about the rising crime rate, about deficiencies in our criminal justice system, like the insufficient number of prosecutors that Merriweather has at his disposal, insufficient number of judges working on a time frame that was developed in the 19th century that has not changed since then. I don't know how much you've spoken with them about this, but have you had any conversations with state lawmakers about the need to improve our criminal justice system in Mecklenburg County and in Charlotte?
So we're working, really, when we go to talk about the kinds of changes that we need, we're now working with the district attorney's office. We'll be working with the county, Mecklenburg County, the justice commission that we have locally, all of those things. And what we have agreed to do is in our legislative agenda that we would have for the upcoming short session, what can we ask for to change this trajectory to make our courts more effectively work with our within the system for people to have justice, both people that are harmed as well as the people that have been arrested for doing things.
We'll come back and talk a little bit more about that and get into other things like Major League Soccer in a moment. Mayor Vi Lyles is with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. WFAE Charlotte Talks is hosting a public conversation to explore what can be done about the city's rising number of homicides. Only halfway through the year, Charlotte has already surpassed 2018's total. CMPD says this problem can't be law enforcement's alone to address, and they need your help. We examine the factors behind our homicide problem and what community leaders are doing to find solutions. Join us Tuesday, July 30th at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church at 7:30 for this important conversation. More at WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Mayor Vi Lyles on our kind of monthly visit with her about all things in the city. We had Chief Kirk Putney on yesterday with Spencer Merriweather, the Mecklenburg County District Attorney, to talk about the rising crime and homicide rates and some of the problems that the two of them see with the systemic problems that make it difficult to tamp down on all of this. Chief Putney says that we make a mistake when we focus only on the number of homicides. He says that number goes up and down. It'll probably be down next year. It'll go up the following year. It's up this year. But that what does not change, he says, is the devastation visited upon the families of the people who die and upon the community at large, which has a ripple effect that we don't even completely understand. Your one opponent so far in the Democratic primary, Joel Odom, has said that is why he's running. He says he's running because of seeing so many young people dying on the street in these shootings, and he says what they need is hope, and he can give them that. You've been the mayor for almost 2 years. You've seen a lot of homicides. What can the mayor do in these cases?
You know, and I really appreciate Joel Odom is a young man that he's participated in our Generation Nation and our Youth Council, and what he represents in this community are people that are passionate about doing this. I really appreciate what he's saying, is because I do think hope is important. But more importantly, we need to determine hope is our value. Safe communities is our goal. And so we're having to work really hard with both our police chief as well as with the court system to do things that are differently. Chief Putney has said things that we need to improve upon about keeping people that have violent crime, have committed or accused of violent crimes, they need to be kept in a place that keeps them out of our communities with the ability to do wreck more havoc on it. And that's both people that have been convicted, like the perpetrator at the Steak and Shake. I mean, it's just, he was convicted of an accessory of a murder charge, 11 years, I think was the sentence, or 9, and he was out in 7, and he immediately went back to wreck havoc in this community and the loss of life as well as someone suffering today. So what does the mayor do? You know, this is where my experience in living and working in the city for a long time makes a difference, and we've got a number of initiatives going on. The chief reviewed the idea of how he has structured a daily review of how we move and allocate police resources around based upon what they're trying to do, which is prevent the next crime. We've also got a huge initiative generated from the chief's office in Hidden Valley to start talking to the people in that community, where we are known that that's a place where crime occurs, generally violence, guns are being used to resolve disputes. But at the same time, we're also working to analyze why these homicides are occurring. In other communities, for example, they have identified attributes of criminal behavior or people that are likely to commit a violent act, whether it be assault all the way to killing someone. And those kinds of attributes we're trying to define for our own city. Another city has an attribute of if you've been arrested 3 or 4 times before you're the age of 15, if you've trespassed on people's property, if you have experienced or been in a place of domestic violence, or if you're violating your parole or probation status. And if you hit 2 of those attributes in this city, they provide you with a mentor or a navigator, which is what our economic opportunity report calls it, to say, okay, you've done these 2 things. This is where you're going. You're going towards a violent end of someone else's life at your hands, and you're going to end up in jail for a very long time. So do you want to change that? And those are the kinds of things we're doing. But I want to say a couple of things. Short term, I want to thank the Y for the program that they have, Level Up Plus, that they've instituted to provide positive interactions and experiences in their facilities for young people by opening their doors this summer. I want to thank our city council for supporting these efforts by providing hot meals. We know that many young people don't have food to eat during the summer, and we don't want them to get that first offense of stealing just because they're hungry as the first thing that they have to interact in the court system. We have programs across this community where people are stepping up every day, but the core group that we've got to look at are those that have that propensity for violence.
And I want to remind folks that we are holding a WFAU public conversation, a community approach to addressing homicides, coming up on Tuesday, July 30th at 7:30 at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. And you can get more details about that at our website at WFAE.org. You recently ended the Environmental Committee, or actually folded it into the Neighborhood Committee. And since that time, several top-level staffers who oversee environmental policy have decided to leave. Is there a connection?
Absolutely not. You know, we have 8,000 employees, and just before I had a meeting, we have 2 really significant efforts going on. We have the Bloomberg American Cities Challenge Grant, and we have an organizational team of some of the brightest people in that work for us, and we sat down and talked about things like, well, how do we change our procurement laws to make sure that we can experiment with things that will help us reduce our carbon footprint? They talked about whether or not, how do we do electric buses in our transit system? You know, it would be very difficult for bus routes that are 12 to 15 miles to be battery powered. But we also have buses that do neighborhood routes mm-hmm. that could easily be in that transition. So we're talking about those kinds of changes. And I believe that, you know, I really want to say to people that come to work in our organization, you know, unemployment's at 3% and people are getting great opportunities. And I would never want someone to stay just because, you know, that would be actually kind of a negative reason to come to work for us. We want people to go out and do more things. Our assistant city manager, Kim Eagle, is going to be the county manager in Gaston County.
Right.
We need to work with her as we talk about how do we build transit in Gaston County, in Gastonia, and the many other cities. We'll be working with her on economic development. So it's great to have those folks move to a place that we're going to continue to be a stronger region, much less just keeping them to do the same thing. I think it's kind of a selfish position to take if you just want people to stay.
She's going to Gaston County. The deputy director of engineering is retiring. We're losing the city's sustainability director. I'm not sure where that person is going, but the city has this energy action plan, mm-hmm. and the goal of that is to make our municipal buildings and our fleet of vehicles zero carbon energy mm-hmm. consumptive by 2030. Do these departures put any of that in jeopardy at all?
No, each one of those folks that left and retired or went to for another great opportunity, there's someone behind them that was waiting for them to say, can I lead? And that's what we'll be able to do. I look at my own career, and I always wanted to make sure that there's someone that wanted my job, because then I knew that I had someone that was going to work hard on the same kind of goals and objectives that we have. So I think our CAP plan, and I hate to say it, but there are probably a few people in our American Challenge work group and our sustainability work group that, you know, see this as a great opportunity for them to take something further in their own career. And that's what I'm hoping for.
Okay. Since the last time you were on, City Council passed a new noise ordinance. It was controversial because somebody believed it targeted protesters at that health clinic out on Latrobe Drive, I think it's Latrobe Drive, that provides abortions. And shortly thereafter, Republican Kenny Smith, your GOP opponent in your first run for mayor, wrote an op-ed for The Observer in which he bemoaned Charlotte's sprint to the hard political left as council members, he said, inserted the city into social policies. He said, if social activism is your passion, run for state government. Really? Do you agree with any of that, either the criticism or the suggestion? And can you be bereft of passion as a local politician?
If you're going to write an opinion column, you can't exactly do it with pragmatism. You have to have words that, you know, kind of fire people up. And so I think he wrote a really good fired up column. Those words are just like, whoosh, you know, there's lots of energy around them and there's lots of controversy around them. But I believe what the council did was study really hard and take a measured approach to what I see as a city that's growing, that we have to deal with the ability for neighborhoods to be in proximity to places where there's going to be noise. And so I think it was a good decision on the council's part.
A week or so ago, the Panthers announced that Bank of America Stadium would host some major soccer events coming up over the course of the next 5 years.
I had the opportunity to be at that press conference, and there was a lot of excitement in the space for soccer.
Are you excited?
I am excited about soccer.
Why?
Well, one, I think that football is great. It's got a great history in our in our country. It's got a great history here in Charlotte. But we are a growing city with many people that want to see diversity in our professional sports. And I think soccer is something that I didn't grow up with, but my children grew up with, and they're very excited about the idea of soccer. My 3-year-old granddaughter is playing soccer right now. She wouldn't be playing football. So there's an audience out there. And
does the U.S. women's team recent victory in France, fuel the fire for the passion for bringing soccer here?
Oh, I think that's part of it. But I think the passion for soccer is when I drive down Independence Boulevard right there at Independence Park, you don't see a football field out there. There's Memorial Stadium on one side, but you see groups of people playing right. soccer. Freedom Park is filled with 3-year-olds playing soccer every Saturday. And so this is something that is another opportunity for us to grow and share in our professional and amateur sports.
So on Monday of this week, members of the league, the soccer league, met with representatives from the city's expansion bid. I'm assuming that means David Tepper's
organization. I think that means Tom Glick and right. the president of the Panthers and the owner, Dave Tepper.
And they made their case. How important do you see the acquisition of a pro soccer team, and what would it mean to our city? If it really came to be, what would it mean? Would it mean as much as the Hornets? Would it mean what the NFL team means to us? Would it mean something completely different?
That's a really good point, because I think every one of those franchises came to a different level of celebration. And again, I think this is soccer would be one where we have millennials, where we have people that have grown up with soccer. They're going to celebrate it a little bit differently than those of us that celebrate it when we got the NFL team. But it's a celebration nonetheless, and I think something of value to our community.
Is there money? Is there political will on the part of the city or the county, as far as you know, to provide money for any sort of enhancements to the stadium, any incentives to make that happen or to grease the skids and make soccer sit up and take notice of Charlotte more than other cities?
The hospitality and sports profession represent 10% of our workforce. And so I expect that we're going to have to balance our growth, just like we've done with other opportunities for economic development, with what we try to do as incentives to get people to make sure that they're here. I hope that MLS will see us as a place that is a great market. I think I heard on your show that Atlanta shouldn't be used as the standard,
right?
Because they are truly kind of an outlier. But I wanted to ask Tom Glick, was it because they actually have hot dogs that cost $4? And I really believe that soccer, with those three-year-olds, if you could come and really afford a $4 hot dog for the rest of your party, a family, that we could be affordable in soccer, I think that it's going to be one of the best opportunities for us in a while.
Speaking of incentives, according to the Observer, the city and county have kicked in something like $16.2 million in incentives for Lowe's, in addition to $2 million in state incentives, mm-hmm. to bring their global technology hub to South End. They're going to put it in a 23-story office building in South End that they will be the sole occupant of, 2,000 jobs paying six figures. It will also help to solidify the city's position in the tech sector. Which is more important, the jobs and the money that they will bring, or our growing participation in technology?
I think both of those are important. We have got to continue to understand jobs of the future require technology. Central Piedmont and our CMS have got to really begin to think about what does it mean for technology and jobs. I think when I listened to Marvin, the CEO of Lowe's, talk about the type of jobs that are coming, software architect, software developer, artificial intelligence, all of those things are what we're trying to make sure that we can compete successfully for. And so we need those incentives to make sure that we land that, but we also need that reputational value that those incentives bring.
That technology center, the Lowe's Hub, will be, as I said, in a 23-story office building in South End. I'm a little fuzzy on precisely where on South End, but it's somewhere back off of South Boulevard.
Yeah.
And I'm told that that's just the first of several projects like that scheduled.
We've already had a financial firm over there open their place one block from the rail line.
So 23 stories is bigger than most of the buildings, all of the buildings over there.
Remember, they were all one-story warehouses 10
right.
years ago, so it wouldn't be hard to be bigger.
And we already know that Tremont and Camden Roads, even that part of South Tryon, are narrow streets already overburdened with traffic. What are you going to do when 2,000 people show up for work at this 23-story building?
We're going to ask them to live across our city. We're going to build a transit line. I want us to fund
our... The building will be here in 2 years. When will the transit line be here?
Well, it'll take a longer time, but we've got the red line, and we're going to have the gold line. I think the gold line is a reasonable expectation for us.
Are we choking South End by allowing all these projects at multiple levels?
I think that's the private sector, the entrepreneurial spirit. I don't know, choking. I think the idea is when someone sees a new place, it may be to the north, it might be in another location, we'll end up with the kind of development that we want. We're working really hard on our comprehensive plan and our unified development ordinance. when it's time for South End to be looked at as occupied 100%, mm-hmm. we'll have other places for people to go.
And I know you want to focus on transportation in the next term. Is that what you're talking about, these other lines coming in?
Yes. I think we're going to open the gateway developer bids, I think, this week, and then we're going to have to figure out how to fund the Silver Line.
All right. Charlotte Mayor Viola Isles with her monthly visit to our program. We always appreciate your being here. Thank you.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks, Charlotte. Have a great day.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.